Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
What a week has been for tech news, with proper juicy investigative journalism, ocean-based online group pirating, and nostalgic celluloid remembering. It can only happen on the UK Tech Weekly. Here we go. To throw an estimate at it, we've all been on Facebook for about a decade. In that time, I shared my data with 81 third-party apps, Dom with 91, Scott with 35, and Lewis with 326. That means that the four of us gave 533 third-party apps our data over 10 years. Imagine how many privacy-averse Lewises there are in the world, and the Cambridge Analytica scandal comes into perspective. The news, though, is that a company harvested data from around 50 million Facebook profiles and then used this data to influence existing political bias, in this case, of the Brexit vote and 2016 US election. But Scott, CA's reach goes further than that, though, and Facebook seems complicit in this involvement.
It does. I mean, this is probably the biggest tech story of the year in terms of reach. I mean, Channel 4 News, The Observer and The New York Times were the kind of main players in terms of breaking this news. But it's really got such a wide ranging impact in terms of the fact that sort of everyone uses Facebook. Everyone kind of just gives their data away for free without considering the implications. And now we're finally starting to see what those implications could be.
It's difficult, but can you sum up what the story is?
Yeah, I mean, it is a tricky story to sort of sum up, but basically what came out this week that made it a story basically is that Christopher Wiley, who you may have seen pictures of because he's got a shock of pink hair.
Yep.
He used to work at Cambridge Analytica, and he blew the whistle on a deal that they did back in 2014 with a British-Russian psychologist. And what he had done is he had created a... his name is Alexander Kogan. He created a sort of one of those sort of throwaway personality quizzes that everyone, or at least all of your friends did on Facebook.
This is your digital life.
Yeah.
It's the app through which that was accessed, right?
Yeah. So tell us some stuff about your personality, your views, and we will tell you what personality type you are. This was all done under the guise of it being a piece of academic research. Kogan then sold the data from that to Cambridge Analytica, which wanted to use it to profile people according to their political views and then target ads at them. So if you showed a propensity for conservative politics, they would send you videos about Hillary Clinton being a crook or something like that.
Yeah.
The main issue here in terms of Facebook's complicity is that they kind of allowed this to happen because their rules for developers back in 2014 was that if someone takes a personality test like that, of which about 300,000 people did, they then gave permission for you to access all of their friends' data as well.
If their friends' privacy settings were open, which many people are.
Which they were by default.
Yes.
Which means that those 360,000 people that were surveyed ended up creating a cache of 50 million Facebook profiles.
Yeah.
For which Cambridge Analytica could then start to target political ads. They did this for the Ted Cruz campaign, and then they were very closely linked with the President Trump campaign. Steve Bannon was on the board of Cambridge Analytica. He was Trump's White House advisor. And then it's also been linked but not proven that Cambridge Analytica provided service to the Leave.eu campaign ahead of the Brexit vote. So really sort of wide-ranging impact in terms of those two elections winning. You definitely, I mean, the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, I think, is on the record bragging about basically winning Trump the election. But
yeah,
I think we can count that out as sort of bragging.
Yes.
But it definitely had an impact. And people are angry. People are really upset that their data has been used in this way without their implicit permission to create political outcomes that they might not agree with.
Yeah, so the argument here is that, first of all, to prove that this is actually illegal is a little bit of a paper trail, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. the research itself was done for free by Alexander Kogan under the guise of academic research.
Yeah.
But then it's his selling of that information to a third party, which is dubious.
Yeah, so the way Facebook frame it is it's a breach of trust.
Okay.
And that's what it is. I mean, it's kind of a loophole because they didn't technically do anything illegal. But what they did do is unethical because the research was done under the guise of it being sort of academic research. But then they sold that for political gain, which is certainly a grey area.
And Facebook claimed that they had ordered Cambridge Analytica to delete the data.
Yes.
But Christopher Wiley claims that the only way that they checked this was done was by getting him to fill in a form.
Yeah. He actually called it a tick box exercise.
Yeah.
They did threaten to send in forensic auditors, but then they were apparently satisfied by Wiley's assertion that they had deleted all the data.
Box ticking.
Sort of, you know, fast forward 4 years, and now that this scandal has been broken to the public, Facebook are now freaking out, and they actually sent in some auditors to double check that all the data has now been deleted so that it can't be used again. But so, that kind of feels a little bit like shutting the barn door after the horse has bolted. Is that the phrase?
Yeah, I think that works. So this story has evolved from Cambridge Analytica being this sort of shady organisation that no one had heard of, mm-hmm. to their sort of slick, slimy CEO sort of being suspended from his job or whatever.
Yeah.
But now the Sauron gaze has turned to Mark Zuckerberg, who he always gets a bit of a bad deal in the press, but sometimes deservedly, because when these scandals come up, it takes him ages to say anything.
Yeah.
And when he does, his long-winded explanations often are ways of not actually apologising or admitting responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't apologise. I mean, he literally didn't apologise.
They use language like they are sort of disgusted that their services have been abused in this way and things like that.
Yeah, he responded with a sort of a thousand-word mea culpa of sorts. He opened it with the line, "I want to share an update," which is kind of ironic because it's like 5 days on from the scandal, and also he kind of saying you want to share an update means that it kind of sounds like he's doing it off his own accord rather than being
hounded by every journalist.
Yeah. And also it could have so easily opened the statement with "I want to start by apologizing," but instead he said, "I want to share an update."
Which is then him basically just outlining the news.
Yeah, he lays out the timeline. Yeah, he lays out the timeline from a Facebook perspective. It all probably checks out, but you know, it's kind of a potted timeline from their perspective, and it talks a lot about breaches of trust and things like that. He then kind of says that they had already dealt with this issue in 2014 when they restricted the rights that apps have to access your friends' data. So basically the way that they harvested the data, they were made aware of this around the time, and they closed off access to the Open Graph API, which is the it's the back end of Facebook, which like links everyone to their friend network. And that was the really powerful tool that was abused for a little while. They kind of closed off the access to that, and they shuttered the service in April 2014. And then he went on to kind of outline three further steps to try and deal with this enveloping scandal.
Okay. Do you have them?
Yeah. First, they're going to investigate all apps that had access to a large amount of data. They're going to change our platform to dramatically reduce data access and conduct a full audit of any app with suspicious activity. Step number two, which is the really important one in my opinion, is that they are now restricting developers' access further to prevent any further abuse. So now they're going to remove developers' access to data if you haven't used the app in 3 months. They're going to reduce the data that you give an app when you sign into any your name, your profile photo, and your email address.
Yeah.
And they're going to require developers to not only get approval, but also sign a contract, in air quotes, in order to ask anyone to access their posts or other private data. So they're making it much more implicit when you're sharing stuff that isn't just your name.
Yep.
So your actual profile data, the stuff that could be useful to a marketer or a political consultancy. The third is that they're going to, this month, put at the top of everyone's newsfeed the tool which basically shows you all the apps that you've given your data to that you mentioned earlier, so that you can start revoking access to them and deleting them. The irony there is that that tool has always existed. It's just been buried in your privacy settings.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, Lewis will need to set aside about 4 hours. It took me a while.
Yeah.
And I had like 35. Because
this is the thing. So, like, this is what I also wanted to discuss, aside from the scandal itself, is our reaction and the general public's reaction to Facebook as a service. Because in some ways, the first step in my mind is that the scandal has to be simplified in order for people to understand it. So I saw, I forget actually who made this point, I'm sorry, but it was that people understood Edward Snowden a lot easier because it was like, people bug your phone, they're listening to you, and people can get that really easily.
Yeah.
We've just shown over the last 10 minutes of conversation that that is about as long as you need to explain everything in this chain.
Yeah.
So this isn't as simple as the whole hashtag delete Facebook campaign.
No.
But at the same time, our relationship with these services and that data as a commodity has to be understood a little bit more. Because I looked at my list of apps, right, and I didn't want to delete everything that was connected to it. I don't want to just delete Facebook. It's not as simple as that. That's quite a backwards way of thinking about it. And for a lot of people, Facebook is so important to keep in touch with people in developing markets. It basically is the internet.
Well, yeah, the Philippines, it is the internet.
So, like, people do need it as a free service. I don't want to disconnect it from my Airbnb because that's how I've been logged in, so I need to use it for that. But then, which philosopher are you?
Yeah.
Apparently I did that once.
The quizzes should go.
That's what I went through and pruned out of mine every single quiz I've ever done.
So yeah, Lewis and Adam, aside from all the apps that you gave permission to over the years, what's your thoughts on this? Does it change your opinion of Facebook, or are you more inclined to sort of distance yourself from this scandal?
I mean, we've always known that, you know, Facebook harvests data, and it's the same as Twitter and everything else. They all take your data. They're all going to market it to other people. So I've just kind of accepted it. But I mean, I don't use Facebook for a lot of things. Yeah. I only really go on Facebook these days. I use it as a login for loads of different services, like you said, because it's just a lot easier.
Yeah.
And then I go on there to watch videos. I don't really publish anything personal on there. I don't do anything political on there. It's a service for entertainment for me.
Yeah.
So I'm not too fast.
What about you, Dom?
Yeah, I'm pretty similar. I've always gone into Facebook and stuff like it, knowing anything I put in is going to be used by someone else some way, somehow. My Facebook is, you know, I'm more of a lurker than a poster. So I use the newsfeed a lot and I sit on that, but I don't put much stuff on my Facebook.
No.
At all.
Go on.
I do think it's really interesting that Cambridge Analytica has been really the straw man here. It's been the target of a lot of the ire. And when you look at the Channel 4 coverage in particular, you can see why, because a lot of their practices beyond the stuff they did with data was completely unethical. But that's a completely separate topic. What a lot of sort of the more astute or the more sort of informed commentators on this subject have said is that no one should be surprised, because this is what Facebook is.
Yeah.
Like, okay, this data was abused by someone to create a political gain that maybe a lot of people in the media especially will disagree with, because it tends to be sort of left-leaning, and so does technology. But Facebook has always been about connecting people, harvesting your data because it's a free service, and then monetizing that for marketers.
Yep.
It's just a bit different if it's Unilever trying to sell you mayonnaise to if it's the Trump campaign trying to get Donald Trump elected.
Yeah.
It hits home a little bit more, but it doesn't change the fundamental fact that this is what Facebook does.
And is this technology showing that it can be like the uncovering of what is basically propaganda? Because, I mean, every political campaign has had its own propaganda in the past.
Yeah.
It's just that if it's a marketing agency coming up with a decent poster, then that's just the simple thing. You've been swayed by that idea. Whereas this traceable seems more invasive, because it is, without our knowledge, taken kind of sort of data facts about us and used it against us in a way that is actually probably legal. In some instances. Is that why people have a problem with it?
Well, at the end of the day, the Obama campaign was extremely social media savvy. The only difference is that a lot of the stuff that they put out there was targeted, but a lot of the stuff they put out was pretty vanilla and also generally factually correct. The thing with the Trump campaign is that they had less of a bar ethically from what they pushed to the people that they targeted.
Yeah, it's
the targeting
way they
isn't new, it's what they did.
Because if you look back, there's a lot of articles around Obama's second election campaign praising his campaign's use of social media and targeted Facebook ads as a great example of the future of political campaigning. And a lot of the same publications that are now, you know, slamming Donald Trump's campaign for doing the same thing were praising Obama for it. But it's sort of a different tone. The Obama stuff was about trying to mobilize people to vote in areas where maybe they wouldn't. The Trump campaign was often about mobilizing people not to vote because they didn't want those people to vote Clinton or for one of Trump's Republican rivals. Or it was encouraging people to vote for minority candidates who would sort of detract from the main things. It was a more sort of negative tone to the way they push things, whereas the Obama sort of usage was more sort of, do vote for the person you want to vote for, but vote for a Democrat.
Yeah.
The Trump was sort of more just trying to, it feels more artificial way of skewing it, trying to push people away from the way they might be inclined to vote.
Yeah. The other interesting thing with this whole scandal is the Facebook response, obviously. It took Zuckerberg 5 days to respond, despite lots of calls to this. I do find it interesting that Sheryl Sandberg doesn't ever get sort of any flack around this. It's always Zuckerberg, but that's by the by. This finally hit Facebook where it hurts. You know, it wiped about $24 billion off their market cap overnight when the scandal sort of hit.
Yeah.
The stock price plummeted. So they kind of had to respond because this is fundamentally a trust issue. And if people don't trust the service, they're not going to use it anymore.
Yeah.
Hence bottom line. So that really has forced their hand to respond. But what a lot of the coverage Wired have been doing recently, Nick Thompson's been sort of embedded with Facebook for 3 years now, I think. The interesting thing is how Zuckerberg has gone from being extremely, maybe naive is the right word, but extremely, you know, mission-driven, community is a good thing without thinking about what the impact of that might be. And he finally now seems a little bit chastened. He seems like he's finally starting to see the power of what he's built to be used for bad rather than for good. And that kind of taking that veneer of sort of utopianism off of Zuckerberg might in the long term be a better thing because he might be a little bit more of a realist leader.
Yeah, hopefully. What can the company really do though, aside from assure us that they're policing these data streams easier? Or is it that we're more tuned into the actual problem and that most people just will be like, oh, it's fine? Or people who don't mind that they've been influenced by this kind of thing, or that they just see Facebook as a tool that is free and they don't really mind?
Yeah, Facebook just need to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. But the problem is it's already happened and there's probably going to be more cases of this sort of thing coming to light. But they'll be in the past because Facebook have kind of put band-aids on a lot of those sort of wounds now. Mm. I personally think they'll be fine.
Yeah.
I think, you know, this is an outcry and it has wiped off some of their value. But I think in terms of the way people use Facebook, it's not really going to change too much long term.
Thank you. Is there anything else anyway if you want to add to this quite big story before we move on?
Good.
Facebook or Face Crook?
Face Crook. I mean, they've always monetized people's data. That's what they do.
Yeah, definitely. Face Crook.
Yeah, Face Crook.
But we're still logged in.
Yep.
Okay. Coming up, some more lighthearted banter about pirates. Nothing like a platform-exclusive seafaring adventure to get the juices flowing. Sea of Thieves is Xbox's latest online pursuit of gaming ecstasy. So, I'm going to stop pretending I know anything about it. But Lewis, you reviewed it. So why is it a big deal?
It's just different to what's on the market at the moment because... Okay, let me just explain the concept.
It's a game.
Yeah, it's a game. First things first, you're not a real pirate. You start off and you choose between two ships. You have a small ship or a large ship. Obviously pick the large ship because you just want to destroy everything. And then you choose whether you want to do it by yourself, which is absolutely boring. Nobody should ever do that. Do not buy the game if you want to play it by yourself.
Okay.
Or you can play with people online. You can invite your friends and play with them, or you can get randomly, you know, you go through the matchmaking process and you get paired with random people online. which can obviously go one of two ways. It can go really well or it can go absolutely terribly. And I've had experiences of both in the last few days.
It sounds like you got paired with a bit of a Leroy Jenkins the other day.
Explain.
Is a...
What, Leroy Jenkins or the story?
So, yeah, do you know the Leroy Jenkins reference? From World of Warcraft back in the day.
God, way back,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the kind of the issue, or not the issue, the positive with Sea of Thieves is that it's basically unscripted. The entire thing is unscripted. You go in and you do what the hell you want. There's a bunch of voyages, which are essentially missions, and they're different types of missions that you can undertake.
Okay.
And they kind of range between killing skeletons, because obviously that's a part of any pirate game. And then you've got one that focuses on merchants. So you'll be kind of sourcing items and taking them to other places. A bit boring for me. But my favourite one.
I'd just sail around.
Just sail around the
really
services.
Chill.
Like an Amazon delivery boy.
But the best one is the gold hoarders, because this kind of gives you the perfect pirate experience, because it gives you treasure maps. And you get a picture of an island, you get a little X on the island, and then from there you have to go to your ship, take a look at the entire map of the entire world, find the island, and then work your way to it.
Okay.
Dig, and then once you get there, you have to dig up the treasure. You have to find that exact spot and dig up the treasure. Now, something, so it can either come in the form of a map with an X on it, or my favourite one is riddles.
Okay.
So nice. They'll tell you the name of the island, you'll get to the island, and then the rest of the riddle will reveal itself. And then you'll have to go and find something, and then walk a certain number of paces in a certain direction, do something else, and then you'll find the chess.
With a team.
Okay. Yes. This is the big thing, is that communication is key in Sea of Thieves.
How do you do that with headsets?
With headsets, yeah. So if you don't have a headset, they do have text replies and stuff that you can use from the controller, but they're not very good.
Okay.
It's much better with the headset, because you can, you know, if you're the captain, you can be steering the ship, you can be barking out orders, telling them to adjust the sails, reload the cannons, all that kind of stuff, because you have to do everything on your ship yourself.
Okay, otherwise it just won't sail.
Otherwise,
anywhere.
Yeah, nothing happened. You'll have to lower the sails, you'll have to adjust
the
angle. Yeah, essentially. It took me ages to work out how to actually sail, because I jumped on the ship and raised the anchor, and I was like, this isn't very fast. I looked up and realised all the sails were up, so yeah.
Right.
When you run your ship, you have to kind of run it as you would in real life. So you have your captain, you'll have someone in the map room downstairs looking at the map and your location and giving you directions, because there's no on-screen map or anything like that in Sea of Thieves.
Right.
You have to rely a lot on communication.
So your character has to actually go and look at a physical map. You're sort of looking over your character's shoulder as they look at a map. And the same when you're going around an island, your character just pulls out a map.
Yeah.
And you try and look at the map.
Do
you actually have some people like peering over each other's shoulder? Oh, one character gets the map out, and someone else like goes and looks at it. And
that's quite
that kind of thing.
Yeah, because you can flip the maps and stuff, and you show it to your teammates so they can have a look without having to get it out themselves. So that's all fun and good when you're just sailing around and looking for treasure and stuff. But it really comes into its own when you start battling other ships, because you're not alone in Sea of Thieves on your ship. There are many, or not many, other ships. There are kind of, I don't know the official number. It hasn't been announced. But I think there must be about 5 ships per server, which doesn't sound like a lot. But when there's 4 people on each one, they kind of starts adding up. And you don't want too much, because you never get anything done.
No.
So are those people looking for the same treasure as you? So you have to fight them.
It kind of ranges. They might not be on the exact same quest as you, but there are kind of world events in the game where everyone can join in. They don't have to. You can work together, or you can just fight it out, and then the winner gets to go on to the event.
Okay.
So these events come in the form, the one that people can join are like fortresses. So you storm fortresses full of skeletons, and this is indicated by a massive skull cloud that appears in the sky at a random time, and everyone in the map can see that. Everyone goes towards it, and then you can talk to people and see if you want to work together or not. But people don't usually want to work together. As soon as you see another ship, chances are you're going to get fired at. And that's when it gets really interesting, because then you've still got to run the ship, you've still got to do the sails, you've still got to do the angles, you've got to do the steering, but you've also got to then fire the cannons, go downstairs under deck, get more cannons to reload it all, and then once you get hit, you'll get holes in your ship, which will then slowly, your ship will slowly sink. So then once that happens, you have to go down under deck and then start boarding up all the holes, getting a bucket, scooping out all the water and stuff while you're still fighting this other ship. So it just becomes, there's a lot going on.
It's
communication
quite immersive,
is key. And you just, the battles don't really last very long a lot of time. There's usually one clear winner. But it's so much fun. And the best part is that you can put yourself in a cannon and then fire yourself onto the enemy ship and then just kill him from there. Surprise!
So has this game been a long time coming? And am I right in thinking this is a Rare game?
It is a Rare game, yeah.
But the sort of new breed Rare, which is now owned by
Microsoft.
What else to Rare, mate?
So historically, they were the big SNES and N64 studio who were made stuff with Nintendo. So they made GoldenEye.
Yeah.
But they also made things like the Banjo-Kazooie games.
Oh, nice.
Perfect Dark,
Jet Force Gemini, yes. Killer Instinct. So a lot of the biggest SNES and N64 games that weren't made by Nintendo themselves were made by Rare. And they worked with a lot of Nintendo licenses. So Donkey Kong Country, Donkey Kong 64, Diddy Kong Racing, things like that.
Yeah.
Microsoft bought them hoping to capture that charm that made them like that. It was a big controversial thing in the industry when Microsoft bought them because it was Microsoft scooping away a big prize from Nintendo. And then they kind of never made anything spectacular again. They made a lot of Kinect games. Yeah. They made Viva Pinata.
Yeah.
It wasn't great. They've just sort of, something got lost in the transition to Microsoft. But then this has been sort of seen as their big comeback game, I guess.
So is it good enough to represent that?
See, this is the question, because it's a lot of fun to play. There's no disputing that. I've had a lot of time. I've played it pretty much every evening this week. And I've had a different experience every night. It's been great. I've been really enjoying myself. I like leveling up my character and customizing it all.
Yeah.
But that's about it. There's kind of one layer to this game where you'll do your quests, you'll do the voyages, you'll level up, but then there's going to come a point where you've done everything and you'll start to get bored, and there's no real end game content at the moment, which is what people are concerned about, because the game is £50, so it's pretty expensive.
And so if you were to play it as one player, I know you've advised against that, but there's no story mode or anything.
No, there's no campaign.
Same things on your own.
Yeah, you're doing the same things on your own in the same servers with ships with four people, and against a galleon, a four-man ship.
You won't last long.
you'll be gone.
So this seems like quite an open-world game, even though you say that there's actually not a lot to do after you've done the amount that you've done. What are the games that are comparable to it? It sounds like it's beating No Man's Sky for fun things to do, but is it like a Fallout game where you kind of like run around in this huge world?
There's no stats or anything like that, so it's kind of, you can't do any leveling or anything like that. Rare wanted to keep it all on a level for all the players. They wanted to make it, you don't want to bump in, if you buy the game 6 months down the line and join in, you wouldn't stand a chance if everyone had upgraded ships and stuff like that. It just wouldn't be fun.
It sounds a bit Assassin's Creed-y to me.
Yeah, kind of, a little bit, actually.
It's a hard one to compare. It's kind of its own thing. Yeah, it's got bits of other... You could compare it a bit to the big survival games like Ark or something that would maybe be the closest thing, but a bit more accessible than they are.
Yeah.
But there
isn't anything that's like it. That's the thing. But it is a game as a service. They said they're going to keep on adding content to it going forward. So once you've bought the base game, you should be sorted. It's kind of like, I've been led to believe that it's going to be a bit like GTA Online.
Okay.
Where, you've got the game and then you just, it'll start rolling out content. And.
But GTA Online had the benefit of launching with a lot already
it
there.
It had a lot already there, and it had, a full campaign to go along with it.
Yep.
And it's the same price as here.
And is that cross-platform as well?
Oh god, I don't actually know about Grand Theft Auto.
Well, it's on multiple platforms.
Yeah, it's on loads of different platforms.
You can't play cross-platform. Oh, I see. But it is on PS4 and Xbox.
But the joy of Sea of Thieves is if you buy it from the Microsoft Store, you can play it on Xbox and PC.
That's it. Yeah.
And your progress will sync between the two, which is always nice as well.
Yeah. So, what score did you give it out of 5?
I gave it a 4. I'm hopeful for the future of Sea of Thieves. It just depends on what the developers add from now on.
Okay. Cool. So you're hopeful for it? Do you think it's going to be supported?
I think it'll be supported for a while. There's such a hype for this game, and Microsoft have focused on it for so long. They're not just going to let it go without a fight.
Yeah. It's a year where Microsoft doesn't have that many big exclusives.
Yeah.
Sea of Thieves is their big game for 2018, so I don't think they're going to let anyone forget about it anytime soon.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Good roundup. Thank you, Lewis. So Sea of Thieves or your pet peeves?
I'll go Sea of Thieves for now.
Cool. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, Sea of Thieves. I haven't played it properly yet, but I'm really keen to.
Yeah, I will never get to play it, but it sounds sick.
Okay, cool. We're thinking good for pirating, so we will be back after this to do some hardcore remembering things.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love.
Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Recently graduated from, as I've said, the School of Remembering Things That People Like and Things That Once Happened, Steven Spielberg felt compelled to turn a quite successful novel into a flashy blockbuster, complete with token English blokes, famous cars from the ages, and a somewhat thin storyline, Dom?
Yeah, that's probably about right.
We're talking about Ready Player One.
Yeah, this is Ready Player One. Not going to spoil anything. I'll get it out of the way. I really, really, really hated this film.
which none of us have seen.
That hasn't been the universal reaction of a lot of other critics, so, you know, take it with a pinch of salt. But I sat through most of the two-hour running time sort of mouth agape in horror and dismay.
Right. Sometimes that can be fun.
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed watching it in the sense that I enjoyed how much I hated it. So this is based on a novel from 2011, I think, by a guy called Ernest Cline, who also co-wrote the screenplay, which is always a bad sign as far as I'm concerned. Right. It's like the 50 Shades franchise. The novelist got involved with the screenplay and apparently sort of tanked that production from within.
Right.
I don't know how much input he had here. It's also co-written by Zach Penn, who's a very established blockbuster screenwriter of mixed track record.
Yeah, well, if Stephen King had been allowed to co-pen The Shining, it would have been a very different movie.
Yes.
And it would have been a way worse movie.
Yeah, very much so. So it's... sci-fi, it's set in 2045, I think, basically in a sort of dystopian world. There's sort of passing mention to the corn syrup droughts and the bandwidth riots as the things that triggered the end of the world. And basically, now everything's a bit rubbish. The world's pretty grim and grey and horrid, but most people are fine with that because they live in a VR world called the Oasis. Which was invented by a guy called James Halliday, played by Mark Rylance, who sort of played as a sort of mix between Mark Zuckerberg and Karma Lucky and the dude
Gandalf
from The Big Lebowski.
Okay. That sounds great.
It's an odd part. Mark Rylance has a lot of fun with him and makes him more sort of tragic and heartfelt than I would have expected. So the idea is he created this huge world, this VR construct that basically is the dominant platform for everything. It's a game, it's a social network, it's just where, you know, so the opening of the film just shows someone going through and everyone you see is in a VR headset, you know, just everyone in their house is in VR.
Right.
And they're all in the same shared world. The film picks up 5 years after this guy's death, and when he died, he made an announcement that he'd left 3 Easter eggs in the game, and whoever could find all 3 would inherit the entire company.
Right.
So that's like being told you got the chance to inherit Facebook. It's, you know,
yeah.
Absolutely massive. The idea is 5 years on, no one's even found the first one yet. They know it's at the end of a race, like a car race, and that's it. And so it picks up there with a guy played by a guy called Wade Watts, played by Ty Sheridan, who is fine. He's there. He's on the film.
He's way too handsome for the role.
Yeah.
Like the character in the book is like meant to be like a geeky, like computer nerdy guy.
Yeah, right. I haven't read the book, I should say. But he's there. He's a very generic, likable Steven Spielberg lead. You know, he's good at doing that face aghast in wonder, you know, looking up in amazement at things that every Spielberg lead has to be able to do. And yeah, so he's a down on his luck guy who basically wants to win the Easter eggs just because he wants the money. He's in poverty and he wants the chance to get this, you know, multi-billion dollar company. And from there we go, and it's him sort of with his online friends, and they're going and doing this race, and sort of the race takes place about 10 minutes in, and it really sets the tone for the film. So it's in this VR world, he turns up, we've had this setup of what happens, he turns up, spawns his car in the race, and oh, guess what? It's the DeLorean from Back to the Future.
Right.
Someone pulls in next to him, and they're on a motorbike. And it's not just enough to see this motorbike, and you maybe see it and think, oh, I know what that is. A character has to make a point of saying, ah, that's the motorbike that Kanata rides in Akira.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, so if I'd gotten that reference, I'd just be annoyed you've told me.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I didn't get that reference, you telling me where it's from doesn't help because I clearly didn't get the reference.
Yeah. Right.
And it's that kind of thing.
But that's then, what the book is. So you haven't read the book, but the book is just reference after reference after reference to pop culture.
Yeah.
And it, like, there are certain passages which are just exhaustive lists
of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And that's what this,
the vibe.
Yeah. Did you enjoy the book?
The book's fine. Yeah. Like, the book's fine. It's quite fun. It's a bit of a page turner. It's at times, that's when it's at its worst, is when he's just rattling off pop culture.
Yeah.
References and stuff. But it's okay. It's very popular.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is the same kind of thing. It's fun. It's Spielberg doing a fun blockbuster. And, you know, the action sequences are nicely put together. Spielberg has always known how to do that. Like, this race is great fun. It's a load of cars. It's all CGI, obviously. They're all going through this huge, like, New York streets race. And then suddenly the T-Rex from Jurassic Park bursts out and starts attacking some of them, and they keep going, and then King Kong turns up, and there's a Batmobile, and there's all this kind of stuff, and, you know, it's thing after thing after thing turns up. Spielberg knows how to string this together in a way that is entertaining to watch. It is a lot of fun, and it looks great. But there's a sort of shallowness to it. That's all you
so,
get.
So you're clearly not the audience for this film. Who might be?
The thing is, Dom is the audience.
Yeah. I love all this stuff. I love everything it references. I picked up loads of them. I've sit there going, I know that. But I hate that my film watching experience has been reduced to.
Right.
It's almost like we are the generation for it, in terms of, like, the references are for our generation, or maybe the generation
maybe before.
Older than us.
Yeah.
But because this movie has to be, like, accessible to younger generations, because that's where the money is at, they have to explain these references, because if my little cousin who's 10 goes to watch this movie, which he would because it's a blockbuster, he won't know any of the references.
And this is one of the things it might struggle with a bit, because the big second act set piece, the big middle of the film, is a deep dive into one specific movie, and I won't give away what it is. And they go, and it actually shows the character basically go into that film.
Oh, God,
film.
Do they do that bit in the film?
Yeah, so it's a big, I think it's 70s or 80s horror movie.
Yeah.
One of the classics, you know, all-time iconic horror film that kids these days will not have seen, because it's A, a horror film, so it's an 18, I think, and B, it's an old one, you know, and it's not one of the big, you know, it's not Nightmare on Elm Street or something, it's not one of the big friendly slasher films. It's a slightly thoughtful horror film. And it's nicely put together at first. They sort of, the characters go in and they actually use old footage from the film, CGI these characters into it, that kind of thing. It's all well put together. But I was just sitting there thinking, well, I get this, but, like, the 12-year-olds you're hoping to win over have no bloody clue what this movie is.
Yeah.
And when these characters are making references to this thing and this thing, they have no idea what any of it means. They can't actually have the payoff of any of the cool stuff from that film, because this has got to be a PG-13, 12A, whatever it is. And so what ends up happening is, the moment it would kick into all the great stuff from that movie, Spielberg basically has to CGI montage everything together and do this CGI mess of all the biggest bits from that film, but made bloodless and action movie friendly.
Right.
And just, it takes this great thoughtful horror movie and turns it into generic CGI spectacle in a way that just, as someone who adores that film, feels almost insulting.
Yeah.
To what it, at first, I liked that section because it felt like a nice homage. It was carefully done, really painstaking in its reproduction. And then it just felt like Spielberg saying, no, but I can make it better, bigger, more fun than that movie was.
This whole
like,
film...
That's not the point.
Yeah, the whole film, which I haven't seen yet, and I will watch it, sounds like it's really suffering from just trying to please everyone. And that's one of the worst things you can do with a movie, in my opinion. You kind of just have to find the audience and just let it be for them, and then hope that everyone else gets on board. If you try and please everyone, it just becomes a bit of a mess.
Yeah. It also suffers from just, there's some stuff like, it's with the online thing, the idea that, you know, all these people go into the Oasis, there's that like underlying message of, you can be whoever you want to be.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and that's sort of the charm of it. You can be whatever you want online.
And there's a few like reveals like that of like character who isn't who they seem like they were online. But equally, it all gets lost in the fact that it boils down to, yeah, but so the lead is a conventionally attractive white guy. And the love interest he meets, who's the beautiful online avatar, and there's all this, oh, you don't know what they're going to be like in real life. They could be like a middle-aged man. No, it's a really conventionally attractive, beautiful, white, like, girl about his same age who happens to live in the same city if he's around the corner and they fall in love. And oh, okay.
So you're basically saying, having seen the incredibly woke Black Panther.
Yes. Yeah. This is not like, that.
To its detriment, yeah.
There's some great people of colour actors and actresses in it, but
yes,
but
yeah.
One of them only appears in avatar form, I think. Letitia Wright.
Letitia Wright is... I'm tempted to say not in this film. She is on the IMDb cast page. Someone actually interviewed her the other day and said, are you in it? And she said, I think maybe I'm in one shot towards the end. I don't know.
For context, Letitia Wright is Black Panther's sister.
Shuri.
Shuri,
who absolutely steals
that movie.
To the point that now she's in Avengers Infinity War as well, and they've suddenly started gearing half their marketing of that film towards Shuri's in it.
Yeah. Well, she in the comics, she actually becomes Black Panther, doesn't she? So yes. I think there's possibly right for them to do that. Anyway.
But, so there's it's funny, if you go on the IMDb page, she's maybe listed the second or third cast member for Ready Player One right now because of IMDb sorts them by their star meter rating or whatever it is. But yeah, she's not. Don't go see it because you think Letitia Wright's in it.
Okay.
And it's got the girl from
Master of None.
Master of None.
Yes, she's got a big part. I can't remember her name right now.
She's
in my head.
Killing it this year. She seems to be doing really well this year.
And she's one of the core cast members. Also great is Ben Mendelsohn, who's the bad guy, sort of evil corporate classic Spielberg villain.
Yeah, so that wasn't mentioned, was it? Like that's one of the, like the key things, like themes of the movie is like it was created as like an open source sort of VR world for everyone to live in, but then there's this company. Is it called The Company?
The company is called IOI. At some point they say what that stands for, but I can't remember.
Who they basically want to win the competition so that they can corporately own it and monetize it. So
there's a fun sort of knowingly over the top bit where Ben Mendelsohn's villain sort of says, we've projected that once we have this, we'll be able to fill 80% of Oasis users' visible space with ads before triggering seizures. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah.
So they could have some fun with
really
that.
Like over the top, that's what it is. And it is, it knows what it is and it hits it hard. Like, this is a movie that, as far as I can tell, unironically, has the line, from hero to villain, a fanboy can always recognize a hater. Like, that is played straight as a character moment. That's the kind of level this is on. And if you're fine with that, if you just like, think that, yeah, that sounds fun, and the Iron Giant is going to fight some other, I won't spoil what, at the end, and, huge robots from many franchises will mash off against each other in a big fight, and then the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles will be there, and, Halo guys will turn up.
This film must have cost an absolute fortune. Not only because of the actors and Spielberg and all the CGI, but also the rights for everything.
And for so many of them, with throwaway things, there's one bit, there's bits where it just rattles through 5-6 references over the space of 30 seconds, all of which are on screen for a few seconds, but each of which has to be it's funny when you watch the credits at the end, is the with thanks to, and there's like three screens worth of corporations listed with thanks to.
This movie's gone through a really interesting cycle in terms of sort of public opinion, because like when it was announced, and I think Spielberg's been trying to make this movie for a long time, he's had the rights to it for a long time. When it was first announced, there was a lot of fans of the book and a lot of people who were just like, I don't want this.
Yep.
This is going to be horrible. And then the early reviews came out and everyone was like, oh, guess what? Steven Spielberg is quite good at making films. And this is good. But now there's like another wave again where, like yourself, people just do not like it.
Yeah.
So it's really gone through a lot of waves. I had no interest in watching it, but I've been kind of sucked in just to kind of see it and see what I think.
I settled on it at 2 stars, which I felt like I was being generous. I was trying to acknowledge the fact that there are some strong performances in that, and Spielberg does know how to make
a big rollicking adventure. Imagine
it
how bad.
Could have been a lot worse. But the general tone from what I can see of other reviews is there's a lot of 3 out of 5s. It's a lot of this is fun, it's fine. I haven't seen many people like falling over themselves in love with it.
Is it Spielberg's worst film?
I really hated War of the Worlds when it came out, but I've been told by a lot of people that I've misjudged
that. First half of that film is really good.
What about Indiana Jones' Golden Skull?
Crystal Skull.
Crystal Skull.
Sorry.
I would rewatch that before rewatching Ready Player One.
Oh god, that's about as bad a review.
That's pretty damning.
And we have Indy 5 on the way from Spielberg as well. Oh, just god. Announced they're filming next year.
Late.
Hopefully Spielberg. The sequel will deal with how the company deals with every player's third party. Data app.
Yeah, not enough discussion of data privacy settings in Ready Player One.
Might have juiced that one up. Well, it sounds not quite as good as Sea of Thieves, but Dom, I don't even need to ask. So I won't make up a stupid rhyme. Maybe go see Ready Player One if you like old things. Go and buy Sea of Thieves if you like new things. And maybe see which apps you've let Facebook have a look at. Yeah. And until next week, thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.